A very good afternoon to you, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you for joining us. I'm your host this afternoon. My name is Adedayo Ojo. I am CEO of Caritas Communications. And this afternoon, we're going to be talking about managing reputation in the COVID-19 milieu. And on the panel, we have Emeka Opara, who is Vice President with Airtel. We also have Adefeko, also a Vice President with Olam Nigeria. The third panelist will hopefully join us in a few minutes. She's Anne Eze. Anne is the Director for Communications for GE's gas power business in Sub-Saharan Africa. Again, we're going to be talking about managing reputation in the COVID-19 milieu. Before I turn this over to our panelists, let me say a few things about the theme. There's this thing about the fact that we have been working remotely most of the time in the last 3 months. And we started talking about, oh, we're going to go back to work. But our thesis this afternoon is that we should be going forward to work, especially those of us with responsibility for reputation management. Why should we be going back? What happened in the past has changed, and it has changed forever. But we should be ready for the new future. It is only in the future, in the forward, that we see the blue ocean. The past is red, and it's not going to come back. On top of COVID-19, we have had globalization and the growth of e-commerce. And those factors and the other challenges that businesses are facing today have led to budgets that have shrunk, and those budgets have shrunk forever. So as reputation managers, we should do things differently than we have done before. Traditionally, even before COVID-19 came upon us, the average reputation manager focused on basic things like doing media relations, events and publicity, government liaison, and community relations. But in the new world that we are getting into, those will no longer be enough. They are okay, but they won't be enough. The reputation manager of today has to focus on things like policy advocacy, stakeholder management, issues and crisis management, social investment, championing branding and business principles, as well as creating opportunity for the business and defending the business. Except and until the reputation managers are able to do this effectively and proactively, they will not be relevant in today's world. So, in summary, it does seem that while COVID-19 has resulted in a tremendous shock to our lives, to our work and our culture, it has also served as a catalyst that is moving us forward. And in moving us forward, is forcing us to answer more complex questions than before. The result is that we now have an opportunity as reputation managers to prepare for how we define what comes next. And the road to recovery, the road to relevance, is what our distinguished panelists will discuss this afternoon. And in that road, there is no going back. Instead, we should be going forward to work with greater purpose, greater humanity, and greater collaborative ingenuity. And the basic tools of our trade, the basic characteristics that every practitioner needs, are such as trust, empathy, compassion, authenticity, transparency, dialogue. They will be needed today more than before. So before I turn it over to our distinguished panelists, I'd like to talk about one or two housekeeping items. Number one is that for our attendees, if you have questions, kindly just go to the panel, your Zoom panel, and type out the questions. I will endeavor to keep an eye on the panel and raise the questions when we get to the segment where our panelists will take the questions. Secondly, towards the last 10, 15 minutes of the webinar, we will share some questions, just about three of them, which hopefully should help us to get how you feel, what you think about this event, with a view that those responses will help us to perform better going forward. Welcome, Anne. So our top panelist is here. So with that, I would like to turn it over to our panelists. Let me start with you, Emeka. Taking the first segment of our discussion, which is crisis communication, how can businesses deliver better outcomes during this COVID-19 era?
Thank you very much, Mr. Ojo. Thanks for the opportunity, and I welcome my co-panelists. It's a very interesting period all of us have found ourselves in. And as I always say to people, anybody who's a crisis manager should always pray for crisis so that you can prove your worth. I once interviewed a casket maker, and I asked him, how do you feel when people die? He said, I feel bad, but I got to do business. So you can understand a crisis manager who sits across year to year and nothing happens. So it's an opportunity for us to prove our mettle. It's an opportunity for us to show how relevant we are in the business. Every business ordinarily should recognize business. Every business ordinarily should have survival strategies to survive crisis. They come in different forms. They give no notice. It could be fire, it could be water, it could be bomb blast, it could be Boko Haram for some of us who operate around the country. So the best way to prepare is to prepare. If you fail to plan to fail. So crisis management means you have to prepare for crisis. First, you recognize the importance of crisis in your business. Most businesses, standard practice is to have what we call a business continuity plan. A business continuity plan must have the crisis segment of it, which most of us manage for the business. Now, it means you should recognize crisis. You should identify various crises that could befall your organization. You can't be too careful, but you prepare for all of them just in case they happen. That's number one. Number two is something called continuous engagement. You must continue to engage not just your employees, you engage the management, you engage the stakeholders, because in the case of fire, for example, you need to know who the fire service are, you need to know where the police are. In the case of Boko Haram, within the north, we knew the soldiers, we knew the GOCs and all that. So you need to manage and continue to engage their stakeholders. Number three, you need to test your plan. So when they do fire drills in the office, it's a test to know whether if there's a fire, people would rather go back and pick up their phones and laptops. You test the plan. The fourth thing you must do all the time is to make sure that you are actually where the action is. If you are a crisis manager, do not belong to the decision-making position. You'll probably be getting feedback from your bosses, and that has a way of making it secondhand. So if you have a plan and you continuously engage and you are managing your stakeholders on an ongoing basis, then you know the media. It is not when there's a crisis, you begin to phone your friends in the media. You need to engage the media. You need to know them very well. You need to continue to engage them as well so that when there is a problem, and when I mean engagement, I mean being their friends, as in true friends, not sending them gifts. That's not it. Most journalists know who are serious mandate. Feel irritated, insulted when you give them give, but be their friend, engage them, be where they are, and they be where you are, so that when there is a problem, they will be there themselves to even forewarn you that there's a problem. A crisis plan must include what I call scenario planning. So you need to look at various scenarios. In my crisis management plan, which is really like 197 pages of document, I had something like infection. And you won't believe it, I had no idea it was going to be corona. I had infection. So I had a plan. What will happen if there's an infection? What will happen if our office is infected? What will happen if our staff gets infected or an infected person enters our office, which helped me in Abuja. When we had a crisis in Abuja, somebody came in after. So at the end of the day, so that I don't waste my time, you must have a plan. That is how businesses can prepare themselves. Prepare, have a plan, engage the stakeholders, and continuously try it and test it and make sure it works.
Okay, thank you very much, Emeka. Ade, is there something you'd like to add in terms of early warning mechanisms that companies could deploy to guard against the unexpected?
See, the early warning mechanisms that Emeka has spoken to are not, I just what you need to have in mind. you need to be prepared. You know, it's just like the maxim or the motto of the Boy Scout: be prepared. Okay, no one expects it, but when it does come, are you ready? So you must be ready at every point in time. So that is a without wanting to repeat, you know, what Emeka has said and has spoken to on this subject, I assent to his submission.
Okay, thank you very much, Anne. Let's have you talk a little bit about how an organization should ensure the well-being of its people and the safety of its assets in a crisis. You know, generally, we all know that when you face a crisis, the most important thing are your people. First of all, that's the first rule. But then, you know, your productive assets are also key. So how should an organization ensure the well-being of these assets in a crisis?
No, thank you, Ade, and hello to everyone on the webinar. I think crisis generally, and today specifically with this pandemic, has really brought safety to the fore. Many organizations used to treat safety like a nice to have. This is no longer the case, right? Now safety is front and center of every business discussion, every business decision. It has really impacted the way operations, management, leadership have been conducting affairs in the past, 6 months now since this outbreak happened. I would say organizations generally clear rules similar to how you manage crisis plan, right? You need to have a safety team. You need to, and not just any type of team, a team that is professional, that understand what they need to do in regards to ensuring safety, not just standard operating protocols for safety, but even unique cases like what we have today with COVID. Then organizations need to invest, right? You have the team, you need to invest in making sure that those safety protocols are implemented, and they cost money. Today, PPEs, thermometers, just making sure that you're closing out 50-60% of your offices to put in place social distancing, all this costs money, right? And organizations have to be willing to take up the charge to implement these tactics and these protocols because they cost money. And then training. Again, organizations take this as, nice to have prior to COVID. Today, it is essential, beyond essential, if there's even a phrase like that, right? They have to make sure that their teams, their employees, their stakeholders, their customers, their providers have the necessary trainings to be able to carry forth and ensure that they have business continuity. That's on one side. On the other side, there's no compromise for safety, whether it's for the employees or for business operations. It is a recipe for disaster. And as crisis management professionals, we can tell you for free that once you compromise on safety, you're just setting yourself up for litigation, for issues, for closure. So organizations must number one, focus, not compromise on safety, and then make sure that they include this in their financial planning. Because this is how you can protect your assets, right? This is how you can protect your operations. This is how you can protect your supply chain. When you include this in financial analysis, you include this in your budget, you include this in your day-to-day, then you're not caught off guard, you're not scrambling. And you can really face this serious head on. Ade.
Thank you. Ade, let me come back to you. Now,
yes.
From our experience in the last 3 months, we've seen that when crisis happens, it impacts both the public and private sectors. And so from your point of view, is there any difference in terms of how the private sector and the public sector should prepare?
I think to a large extent right now, the private sector is usually more prepared than the public sector. I spoke to something a while back as to what happens in government, or what used to happen in government prior to now, was that government used to set the agenda for citizens, but right now citizens are setting the agenda for government in terms of how government reacts to what the citizens want. You see, government always has this proposition, or always has this belief that they know the problems of the people. But if the people don't tell you their problems, you cannot appreciate and help them to solve those problems. And that's what is happening right now. Emeka and Anne have spoken to, you know, crisis communication, particularly with respect to, all of us have safety protocols, we have all those best practices, you know, but sometimes these things don't rear their heads. But when they do rear their heads, most times we're always ready. And because we're crisis managers, we're always on the front line. You always find the MDN. And that's why every serious organization must make sure that anybody in charge of communication who manages reputation must be on the management team so that you do not get any watered down information. That is why you find out that even at the Federal Executive Council meetings by government, the current government, you find out that Femi Adesina sits in council so that he listens to everything that's been said. So it's not a question of, you know what, this is what we discuss at this meeting. And so what are the steps? He's there sitting, taking notes and being proactive and knowing how to be proactive rather than being reactive. Half of the time, we're always reactive rather than being proactive. So we must have that proactive plan, very important. You know, I was talking about government, about the citizens setting the agenda. The citizens are setting the agenda now. Let me give you the two quick examples. Look at the NCDC Act, which the lower house wanted to introduce, okay, and giving powers to NCDC, more or less like, you know, making NCDC the be all and end all for health related activity. But you know what happened? The citizens said, no, you can't bring this bill and you want to pass it. You need to consult us. We are the ones, we are the people, we are the citizens. So please let us know what does this bill contain and what is the likely impact of this bill on us. So there's the citizen government dialogue. And when it was shouted down, the lower house has now invited citizens for a public hearing. And now we're having that dialogue and engagement. It is very, very, very important. You see, what is important in relationships, okay, which my two earlier panelists spoke to is relationship. You initiate, you nurture, and you sustain. So there's no point initiating a relationship, okay, nurturing it, but not sustaining it. So it's like Amika said, you don't call a journalist at any point in time or any legislator and say, you know what, I have this for you, I have that for you. No, it's not about that. It's not about that. You need to constantly engage. So those relationships are very, very important.
Okay, thank you. All right, just before we leave the subject of managing crisis, Emeka, how would you, if you, in 1 minute, how would you advise corporate bodies, public and private, to think going forward in terms of the importance of managing crisis that we have established in the last 10, 15 minutes?
Thank you, Ade. I think difficult. I even dealt with it already for me, if you ask me. And the reality is this. Any serious corporate organization or government establishment should, as a matter of fact, as a matter of functionality, have a corporate communication person who is also empowered to deal with crisis. That's number one. And every business and every organization must recognize the fact that crisis will occur. If you recognize the fact and you employ somebody who is knowledgeable, who is trained, who has the skill sets, and I repeat, who has the skill sets, because the problem we have with some of our colleagues, our people answer, they pick up titles, okay? And then when the chips are down, the marketing director or the technical director is treated more responsibly than you. I've had this conversation all the time. If you are going to be a corporate communications person, who's going to be in charge of crisis and people don't respect you, there are four things you must do, and I can say that very quickly. Number one, you have to be an expert. If anybody in that business can speak better than you, you are dead. If anybody in that company knows more people than you, you are a dead man. You're not serious. That's number one. Number two, you must know that business you're working for. I mean, Anne works in a high impact gas. I mean, she must be a roving encyclopedia when it comes to gas. She probably didn't study anything about gas, but you are going to work for a gas company. You must know gas, the gas industry, the business. Know your business. You also have to know your numbers. There are numbers that come out of any business. Your results, your profit, your whatever, the consequences, the crisis, the volume of the barrel of gases, the trains of gas that travel to China. You must know your numbers. Number four, you must be the best, as I said, in writing and speaking. And then your connection must be the best. You must have world-class connection and network. When your business wants somebody. My MD called me and said, Meka, I want to make a donation to the PTF on COVID. Please, I need to speak to the secretary of the government. He just threw that at me. Can I get his number and talk to him? In 2 minutes, I sent him the text. He said, you know him. I said, I don't know him, but I have his number. That's all the man wants to know. If you took a day or two to come back to him, he will hire somebody who will do it better for you. And you might be a lawyer. You might be an engineer. And then you are finished. The other thing is you must know the media. For you to be able to deliver this thing convincingly and your business can entrust you, you must have a good network. You must know the media. You must know the number. You must know the business. You must know that business you work very well. You must be an expert in the area. There's nobody anywhere that could do better in the business better than you.
Okay. So thank you, Emeka.
Are the key elements that you must have.
Thank you. Again, thank you. Distinguished ladies and gentlemen, this afternoon we are discussing managing reputation in the COVID-19 milieu. Let's take the conversation a little bit towards CSR and sustainability. And Anne, I'll come to you first. Given your experience and what you have seen in the last few months, in what ways has the changing times, COVID-19 and all the other externalities that are affecting business, in what ways do you think those external factors have reshaped corporate social responsibility strategies?
Thank you, Mr. Ojo. CSR is one of my favorite topics. I mean, for 10 years, I was leading the National Electric Foundation during my time there, and even now with GE, very heavily involved in our CSR activities. And it has just been a huge awakening for corporate, for business, for government, on how CSR, the role, the importance, and the strategic connotation for CSR today. It's also evident that there's a critical connection between CSR and the key stakeholders for any organization, if it's the employees, if it's the regulator, the stakeholders, very critical connection that is really emphasized day in, day out, as we have seen this pandemic progress. But again, it has been a double-edged sword. So on one side, you see CSR becoming top of mind for organizations, but you also see where they are faced with clear challenges, falling revenues, they have to lay off staff. So it's kind of a balancing act that they have to face right now. On one side, they have to show that they're socially responsible. They have to make donations, involve themselves in all the different initiatives that government or their even own enterprise is putting on the table. But on the other hand, they have to match this with the need to reduce costs, lay off people, reduce the just the overhead, right, that they use in running the business. So it's kind of, like I said, a double-edged sword. Okay. Clear impacts, very, very, very now high top of mind, but the budgets are thin and, very tough to navigate today.
Okay, thank you. I like the last point you made about, things becoming tighter with budget. And Ade, I'm coming to you. Now, so externalities have become major in dealing with our job. Budgets are shrinking. Revenues are disappointing. So is CSR still crucial?
CSR is crucial and will always be crucial. CSR is tied into, CSR is tied to sustainability. Sustainability is at the core of every serious business. And we need to understand that very, 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 very critically. You talk about, gas emissions, carbon footprints, and all that. They are all linked, okay? You talk about, of course, we always speak to the Millennium Development Goals, okay? Sustainable Development Goals prior to that, okay? Millennium Development Goals and Sustainable Development Goals post that. All these are very, very, very important. CSR is important as well because any community where you operate, you need to stand up to be counted. You cannot operate, you cannot operate. Every man is a piece of the island, So no man is an island. Every man is a piece of the continent. That's what is usually said. So sustainability is at the core. CSR is at the core. So it is critical and imperative that you have it done. So you find that a lot of organizations, big or small, no matter how, infinitesimal, something is done. Okay, look at this COVID period, for example. It was important to approach it from most times. I think a lot of organizations approach it from three-pronged approach from organizations. One, some of them decided to donate cash, okay, and said, you know what, let's donate cash, you know, towards a private sector cause, for example. Two, some decided to give out palliatives in terms of foodstuff, okay, because a hungry man is an angry man. And again, when you're talking about health, you have to balance health with well-being, okay, and food security. So they donated food relief, food relief. And thirdly, there was a lot of awareness, okay, and enlightenment campaigns on the ills of COVID in the communities where these respective organizations operate. So be it technology, be it FMCG, be it oil and gas, it was important to make sure that in your community, where the communities where you find yourself and where you operate, you needed to send that message across. And again, another thing which people don't usually speak to is you always talk about external stakeholders. What about your internal stakeholders, your staff? It's important to let them know what is being done and carry them along at every step of the way. Borders are shrinking, but we are being innovative right now by doing a lot using technology, okay? This new normal has brought to fore new realities and new challenges. So the new normal right now will be defined by how we leverage technology to get our job done, which is what we're even doing right now on this webinar. We're leveraging technology to have, I mean, prior to now, you would have called us to one hall somewhere where we would have had to pay. Don't get me wrong, that value chain is suffering right now, but again, that's it. Some win, some lose.
Good. Thanks, Ade. So, Emeka, I'm going to come back to you. Now, I mean, and thank God all three panelists, you sit on your management committees and see what's going on in the organization. So as revenues fall due to COVID-19, what are the unique challenges that the old concept of sustainability and CSR, what are the unique challenges that organizations will face today?
I think the primary challenge is the budget. And I think Anne alluded to it. Ade also alluded to it. Budget is an issue. But then this begins to task our creativity as human beings. As managers, we must be creative. Now, sustainability, as the word suggests, is sustainable. You're just not going to go and build a school somewhere and run away. That's not CSR. That's not sustainability. I'll give you an example. I took a school in Ajegun so many years back, rebuilt the school completely, renovated it, brought school uniforms, put white boards for the kids, put a generator, did everything for them, built classrooms, put water borehole. I change their uniform every year. I give them textbooks and exercise books. And I go back. I do this every year. For the past 8 years, I've been doing that. Just that school in Lagos. And I can tell you that because of the impact of what we in that particular school only, Lagos State government felt obliged to come and rehabilitate all the other schools in the vicinity. That's when you talk about the knock-on effect of, you know, a sustainable investment in the environment. Secondly, I've been going back to that school to see that the teachers in that school are winning awards. I spend money training the teachers every year. Now, I find out that many people are now leaving their own schools and coming to that Airtel school because it's actually a better school. So that's how you measure sustainability. We are recreating something. So this time we'll task our ability to think about what we're going to do that will lead into the future. That's number one. It will also task us, having to convince management, because as you and I know, we are not in the business, we're in the business for me to do telecoms. I'm not in the business of building schools or building roads. However, to be a responsible corporate citizen, I must invest in those things. Either is infrastructure or something, because there's a target. The sustainable development goals, as Ade alluded to, all of us buy into it. So we must. There is one critical element as well, which is the employee part. At the end of the day, your staff must be your greatest assets. So today, we are working from home, right? I will need to spend money. I know one company who has bought data. They bought broadband devices for their staff to take home. They bought data, extra data, to give them to stay home. So these guys are happy to work from home, join Zoom sessions, attend meetings online. So you need to think about employees first, because charity really should begin at home. I have initiatives that I do where I tell my staff, I say, you guys must nominate one project I must do. In that sense, employees feel a sense of belonging that we are the ones that nominated it. I need to bring employees more to be participants, observers, not just observers. So I take them to those schools to go and teach the children. My staff will have to go and organize Zoom classes, and we'll put internet in those schools to teach those kids little skills they can learn in the period. And therefore, staff can also contribute money. Airtel staff, for example, donated from their pocket 20 million to Lagos State. I mean, you can't tell me that people will willingly throw money if their mind is not there. All of us are part of the thing. So over time, and I think Kade made a point, communication is crucial. You need to recruit employees as ambassadors, recruit them as members, believers, who will work with you in all your efforts, internally and externally. So our activity will be taxed, and we are going to have to engage management more to see that even though the business is shrinking, revenues are dropped, we don't want to run away from the environment. All those who showed up during COVID, they are looking laughable. But those of us who have been there before COVID, it's like a matter of course. So don't wait until crisis comes before you support government. So many of us, we're already in partnership with NCDC before today. So if you have any emergency, friends call me, say, Mekabe, can you help me call NCDC? Somebody is sick. And I'll call it, I'll make a call, and they get tested. It's an alliance I made way before COVID. And like I said, we must have connections. So these CSR people, or people who handle corporate responsibility, must be powerful people, must be connected people. And you won't say, I want to talk to the NCDC people, or with an emergency in our office, you can reach out. This is the new normal, as Ade calls it. You must then dig in properly to see how to leverage on the situation and your skills and your contacts. That's the new challenge we have. And okay. I think we are living up to it, as I can see.
Thank you very much, Emeka. Distinguished ladies and gentlemen, once again, our theme is managing reputation in the COVID-19 milieu. I noticed that the questions are pouring in. So I'm going to throw the first one out. And let's start with you. This is not directed at anyone. So I will leave it open for any of the panelists to take a bite at it. The question from Winnie Gathage is, how can public relations agencies and busy communication departments rethink employee wellness, that is, their mental, physical wellness, especially because these departments, whether it's the in-house communications department or the agency, are usually busy around the clock? And what are you doing? What will you recommend, given your own experience? Again, the question is, given how busy communications people are, whether they're on the agency side or on the corporate side, how can we, despite being busy, rethink employee wellness? That question is from Winnie Gathage. So any other panelists want to take a shot at that?
See, for me, employee wellness is not something that should be handled by a department. It's a collective thing, okay? It's a collective thing. The only, the person who's at the center of it in getting it, you know, immersed or imbibed is just the communications department. But it's a company thing. And at this point in time, critical points in which we're living in a new normal, you know, perilous times you might call it. You know, employee wellness is critical and very, very key. You need to understand how your employees are living, how they are faring on a day-to-day basis, checking on them, which is why, for example, in our company, on a weekly basis, this MDC reaches out, okay, on Zoom to staff, just, you know, inquiring how they're doing. I had to arrange that because I said, you know what, these guys need to know that they are still part of us, on the one hand, and two, we still care. It's important to show that empathy. Half of the time, employees always tell you, they don't care about us. I mean, I'm sure you all know that song that made Michael Jackson sang, they don't really care about us. But you need to show them that we really care about you. And that communication on a regular basis, championed by the communications department, is a very, 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 very good step and will go a long way. And that, I think, is something that should be, you know, should be adopted by a lot of organizations. Because well-being and safety is very, very, very important. Right now, These times, people are lonely. People are just saying to themselves, what does the future portend? Will I still have a job at the end of this crisis? Those are the critical questions. So it's not a communications department thing. It's not an HR thing. It's a collective thing. But who disseminates or who arranges it? It's the communications department. So our role is very, very critical. On a day-to-day basis, I've not seen, these times have just shown us that, you know what, we are at the forefront, okay? The same way you have frontline medical staff, okay, the communication guys are at the frontline right now because they're the ones that inform, educate, and disseminate this information.
Okay. Thanks, Ade. But Mr. as Ojo, a writer to that, okay, Anne, go ahead. Anne, go ahead.
Yes, I was going to say, this is a very interesting question because as employees are working primarily from home, there's no, you know, face-to-face interaction, there's no social connection. So they really, that feeling of being alone is heightened at this point in time. And communication professionals with leadership, with HR, have to be intentional around bringing employees together. It has to be intentional effort. No longer the, you know, once in a quarter town hall or once in a quarter newsletter. It has to be more frequent because, again, this is the usual environment for connecting and for talking and for, you know, just collaboration do not exist because of our new virtual platforms. If I give an example of what we've done in the recent 2 months, we have literally done exercise challenges on WhatsApp. We have brought everybody together on WhatsApp and we have done exercise challenges. We have done cooking challenges. We're thinking of doing reading challenges, right? All to continue to keep that, you know, collaboration effort, that really familiar work environment so that people continue to be motivated to give their best and don't feel isolated. So very much aligned with Ade, it has to be intentional. It has to be in collaboration with leadership, with human resources, and it has to be consistent.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Emeka, I'm going to come to you with the next question. The questions are coming in torrents, and I don't want us to just leave everything towards the end so that our participants also get engaged. So this question is from Taiwo Obe, the one many of us know as Tio. So Taiwo says, talking about knowing how many companies allow their corporate communications practitioners to get really integrated into the company, having a finger on everything that the company does. Now, he says, in reality, how many corporate communications practitioners are even interested in knowing beyond their daily routine of managing reputation? You know, and I know Emeka talked a lot about that. So I'm going to ask him to take the first shot at that.
Well, I think Tio is lamenting. So I'm not going to join him in the lamentation. But the reality is that it is a bit unfortunate that some people have reduced corporate communication or public relations to wearing very nice attires and looking spiffy and speaking for name, as they say in the village, you know. Guy, this is real work. And I can tell you, the only way you can get into the executive management of your business is if they know that you know the business. So I go into ESCO meetings on Tuesdays and we do 8 hours. You see the engineer come with graphs and charts. You see the marketing guy come with graphs and charts. And when it's my turn, you want me to come and speak English, I'll bring graphs and charts. Man, I know how to make graphs and charts. I have charts of media coverage. I have charts of crisis. I have charts of donation. I have charts of every activity I've done. Made in nice graphs and charts. When it comes on the screen, people also respect you. You hide a few things so they can ask you questions. What has happened is that most of our guys just come in there. Do you have anything to say? No, everything's okay, sir. We look nice. That's rubbish. And it comes from that point I made. You need to be the experts in your area. So anytime there's something, the boss turns to you. People come to you. People come to my office as if I'm like, come, how do you think I know this guy? You should know now. You should know. All right. So during this pandemic, as things got to a height, we have what's called employee knowledge series, where we invite somebody from outside to come and talk to our staff in our amphitheater. And I'm like, okay, we have Zoom. I can take in 500 employees. I got Chikwe of NCDC. Chikwe was in Abuja on Zoom. So he spoke to my staff for 30 minutes and they asked him questions. He couldn't get any better during this pandemic than to speak to the man himself. And they interviewed him, asked their questions, he shared experience and knowledge and everything with them, just to say. So these are the kinds of things, you know, but like I said, you must make yourself relevant in any organization that you work. If you are somebody who just speaks English and wears good clothes and wears good perfume, they won't take you seriously. So when you come to ESCO and the guy in networks, I'll give you this example. My guy is in networks. They have very crazy charts, the best charts you can find on earth. And they'll tell you the percentage of network coverage in Parkview is 98.9%. And I raise my hand. The man said, "Make I come now." I said, "Yeah, I have a question to you." He said, "Okay, so how does 98% translate to me losing my Zoom call yesterday?" And the guy says, "Emeka, you have come now." I said, no, because you're talking about 98%. I'm talking about practical reality. I'm consumer-facing. People call me from Abuja and say, "Emeka, your network is bad." They are telling me 98%. So you need to get to a point where you translate those figures to consumer affairs. We are consumer affairs people as well. The consumer talks to us and not the engineering guy. They don't know him. The engineer doesn't even know who is using his product. So you must be very knowledgeable. You must also understand the numbers, your organization truth. So somebody challenges you. That is the only way you can get into top management. I can tell you that most top organizations are willing to open the door and let you in. It is not just by putting your name on the organogram, no. But the moment you show that you have, I joined this company as a manager, and over the years, I was able to find my way because I continued to insist that I won't let the guys in regulatory and government affairs only be the ones doing the lobby. So I write articles on 5G. I write articles on critical national infrastructure. Sometimes I use pen names. I can reveal them. And these write-ups hit government. And government read them. In fact, my CEO told me that the minister forwarded my write-up on 5G to him. I didn't say I work for Airtel, but he thought that was a fantastic write-up. He sent it to my MD. My MD said, "Emeka, you're running in Abuja." That's respect. I mean, he can't mess with me. And anybody who is in corporate communication, you don't write articles. You don't publish ideas in the newspapers. Ade is probably the only person I'm constantly pursuing me. You need to write articles in the newspaper, discuss your business, show that you understand telecoms where I work and works in oil and gas. She will write something in the paper that so people are dying to understand. We put it in the language that people will appreciate. They'll respect you. When they Google, I went to Uniland and students told me that they were at a seminar and we used your write-up on XYZ to discuss at the seminar. I'm like, why didn't you invite me to come and spend 1 hour with you guys? I will happily come and do it. This is where corporate communications people should be, at a knowledge level. At a knowledge level. Once you show knowledge and you're high-minded and you have the right network, they will respect you. When they see you with the VP and see you with the minister and see you with all those people, it's not at Owambe party. It's at serious events. When they know that you have the contact to save the business, they will let you into the top floor, which, I mean, we always say the C-suite, which you should be. And that's really what people need to do. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Emeka. You know, as you talked about what the role of the practitioner should be and how to earn respect, it just reminds me of my very early days as a public relations practitioner in an oil and gas industry. And we were going to conduct an interview for potential scholarship beneficiaries somewhere outside Lagos. So I was in the team that goes ahead, you know. So my boss came the following day and then he said, "Oh, Mr. Ojo, how are you?" And this was my very first month on the job. And he said, I ran him through all the arrangements. I've gone to the university, I've gone to the schools, I've contacted most of the people. He was very happy. So we had dinner, and at the end of the dinner, he said, "So young man, where is the other one?" And I said, "Which ones?" I said, "Blankets." Oh, I said, "Oh," and naively I said, "Oh, the blankets are not the beds." I said, "Very good." And then he got to his room and called. He said, "Mr. Ojo, do you want to work in this company at all?" I said, "Sir, I don't understand." He said, "When I said blanket, don't you understand?" And sincerely, I didn't know what he meant. And, you know, so our job has evolved from those days when you provided blankets and drinks and all of that to getting serious, to being intellectual about what we do. Again, ladies and gentlemen, we are talking about managing reputation today. And today, the day of externalities, the day when COVID-19 has come upon us and we don't know when it will go away. Perhaps when it is going away, something else will come. So with that, we're about halfway through our discussion. So I've also go into the next segment, and Ade, I'm coming to you with this. Talking about lobbying and government relations, in the experience of many of us, lobbying could result in undue influence. It could result in unfair competition, and it could result in regulatory capture. Should lobbying be regulated? Ade?
Everything to a large extent is open to regulation. But what you always ask yourself is, what are you regulating? Are you regulating the way I speak? Are you regulating the way I engage? Are you regulating the way I build relationships? You can't do that. What is important is, you see, what you should understand first and foremost is what is lobbying. Lobbying is an art, okay? Your ability or the art of trying to influence policy for public good. You hear what I said? The art of trying to influence policy for public good. That's what lobbying is in a nutshell. So regulating it, I mean, as long as it's for public good, there's nothing you're trying to regulate. You're trying to regulate there, okay? What you should just be very careful with is to make sure that whatever is proposed or whatever is advocated or whatever is being solicited is for the public good, okay? And that is critical. And, you know, that's where your relationships come to form. And relationships, I cannot overemphasize, is critical. I have been in this lobbying and communications business for upwards of 20, 25 years. And you know, because of my checkered career, I was a former banker, okay? I was in paid television. I was in tobacco. And right now I'm in agriculture. So like Emeka spoke to the earlier question by T.O., as an addendum to what he said, it is important to be knowledgeable. To a large extent, I worked in a bank. I've managed a branch. So I understand balance sheets, okay? So you can't come and give me a chance and start saying, hey, I look at the figures and say, it's not adding up there. You look at me and say, okay, this guy is our vice president, corporate and government relations. How does he know this? I have an idea of the business. And when I sit in the room, I always tell people, do not allow the corporate affairs function be an appendage of the MD's office. What we used to have in days gone by was that you had that a corporate affairs person being an appendage of the MD's office. For like you spoke to something talking about providing blanket. I would not provide you a blanket, I will get you a bed, you know? And again, we are speaking about knowledge. Knowledge, you have to knock at the door. If you don't knock at the door, they won't open. And if you knock at the door and they don't open, you force your way in and you sit down. So a seat at the table is critical, because when you sit at the table, you're able to influence policy, put policy across. I've said it at numerous webinars. What do you bring to the table with respect to an issue or to a subject matter? That is critical, okay? So lobbying, I do not think should be regulated in any way, because you cannot regulate the way I engage, the way I initiate relationships, the way I nurture them, and the way I sustain them. What is important at the end of the day is public good. That public good is critical and very important.
Okay, thanks. Let me come to you now, Anne. So, I mean, thank God you've been in energy, power, oil and gas related business for more than a decade. Now, so talking about advocacy and lobbying, how do you strike a balance between corporate interest and public good?
So I think the first thing is to establish what the values are. Right. What are the corporate values, and how do they stack up against the public good? So if your values are, fingers crossed, they are right, they are just, they are true, they are ethical, they should align with the public good. That's number one. Two is, we have code of conduct for the very reason of, you know, transparency and I mean, Ade doesn't want to use the word regulation, but really as a North Star, right, to guiding actions and making sure that corporate ambitions, corporate interests, and the public goods continue to align. Sometimes, you know, we also need those code of conduct to be able to ensure that, you know, people are not circumventing the process, they're not twisting policies to suit one party or one interest over the other. I would say everybody has spoken about it, relationships are the bedrock of lobbying. So if you, the strength of the relationship would also, you know, impact or influence how you show up. Because if you already have a bad reputation, you already have your organization has been labeled, tagged, and bagged as no good, then you have no leg to stand on. You have nothing to use to advance your ideas or ideologies, even if they're for the public good, right? So it's a slippery slope, but I think one that professionals with tact, with experience, and with the right relationships can navigate perfectly to make sure that, you know, they continue to stay on the right side of the law and they continue to align corporate interests with the public good.
Okay, thank you. I like the way Anne ended making her point about talking about, you know, navigating between here and there. So I'll come to you with that, Emeka, and say that, you know, in view of the reality that we have to deal with today, which is that in-person meetings have reduced and the situation may remain the way it is going into the future. So how can government relations professionals, like your good selves, people manage relationships with government, with other stakeholders, how can you stay informed and verify information received given the realities of today?
Thank you. Okay, again, that's why I said it's good to build and sustain relationships. That's the bedrock of government relations or any relationship management, be it media or whatever. It is relationships. You must have relationships that are deep so that if anything pops up in Abuja, you'll be among the first person to know. And okay, back in the day, we will fly into Abuja and spend the week and come back to Lagos or fly in and spend the weekend and attend parties, attend funerals, attend naming, all those relationship building activities. But I hope you know that it is during those sessions that we also whisper to them a new initiative. It's also during that time that you tell them that, guy, I'm coming to your office next week or there's this proposal we have. It is at those sessions. Because let me tell you, people take politicians that there are some of them are very smart. Those who are serious, they are smart. They know exactly what you want and they can help you if you are really serious. Some of them also need somebody to help them. Are they mentioned something about knowledge? If you are knowledgeable, you can actually draft a law and give it to a senator to present. Because you are knowledgeable, you educate him, draft it and give it to him. He will be so beholden and so grateful to you that, man, you have done this for me. So the point is this. Thank God we have Zoom. Thank God we have our telephones. So we can continue to keep in touch with our contacts. We can continue to exchange ideas. We can continue to share notes. The emails are there. If anything occurs to you about a particular new area that you want government or in your own industry to pay attention, share it very quickly, have a conversation with the person, organize small meetings, then enlarge the meetings. It's still the same process. The only thing missing here is we're no longer making face-to-face contact. But because of the impersonal nature of this, you need to now go back in that your emotional bank account, which you have built over time, because that's what we do in this our business. You have to build an emotional bank account. The man who doesn't see you cannot really tell what your body language is. But if you have bought into this guy very well and he into you, you call him on the phone, you can discuss billion-dollar conversations. You have billion-dollar conversations. So it's all about what you bring to the table, the knowledge you bring, the experience you bring, how you support him. You can even find out that something is happening in the UK, in telecom, for example, which the Nigerian man here is not aware. You tidy it up and put it together and send it to him. The guy will thank you. And when policies are going to come, you remember that this guy was one of the guys that helped me to understand how this thing works. You buy books on different industry. You buy books on different laws. You share with them. That is where knowledge comes. When you give them those materials, they will give to their PE. Even their legislative assistants will now be calling you as a consultant. You are the man that's going to benefit, but you are the man that's going to help them, prepare them for it. It's a mutual thing. And that's why Ade says, if you regulate it, you then affect the way I relate with my man. The idea is for me to go in and out, help them understand the laws. Now, look at the issue of 5G. Let me use that as an example. When the thing started blowing, you realize that the minister, for example, was skeptical. If you read his statement, it was different from the statement that the NCC issued. Now, the NCC man understood it. The minister was from a populist point of view. By the time we sent in submissions to him and tried to educate the man, And he turned around immediately. Today, he is almost suddenly championing the early process of launching 5G in Nigeria. And this thing has been tested before now, before the alarm started. But like I say, it's a two-way street. You always have to go in and come out and bring something to the table, which is knowledge. And their relationships are wonderful. You must build relationships over time. So that when there's a lockdown and you can no longer go, then you know that that relationship you built over time will tie you back.
Okay. Thank you, Emeka.
Can I quickly add something to that?
Go you ahead, Adi.
What Emeka has just spoken to is very, very critical. See, what we should practice right now, what I believe we're practicing right now is physical distancing, not social distancing. Because social distancing will mean you're not in touch with this person on phone,
that's right,
via WhatsApp.
That's right.
So it's we're practicing physical distancing, but not social distancing. So please, let's get it right. We're constantly in touch with the people we need to be, giving them information that they need on a continuous basis because we've built relationships over time. And that should not be affected. You when you send a message to someone on WhatsApp on what he needs with respect to anything, he looks at it and says, "Oh, this came from my day." And like Emeka said, the legislative aides half of the time don't have that information and not knowledgeable. So when you help them with the body of knowledge you have, it helps.
Okay. Good. I mean, and that's a very good one. You know, if we distance socially, that's a problem. Again.
Yes.
And you know, one of the phrases I picked up from Emeka a couple of minutes back was helping to help. And I like that. So before we leave talking about government relations and lobbying, let's talk a little bit about how can we also help those who are on the other side, those who make the laws. You know, back in the days when I was government relations manager for ExxonMobil in Abuja, I remember that one of the key challenges we had was, even though I could speak for the company, I was well positioned, they knew me from day one. The challenge was occasionally, because of personal interest, they insisted the only person we want to talk to is the managing director. Now, good for us, those of us who are on the corporate side, today you cannot even insist anybody must come because you must observe physical distancing. How can those who make laws and regulations, how can they take advantage of what we see today, the challenges we see today, how can they turn it around into an opportunity, just like you guys have been talking about, look, this thing is an opportunity for us to move from the back, from history into the future. So let's talk a little bit about what are the opportunities for those who make the laws that we have to lobby in order to get the right policies in place or the right regulations in place?
Can I speak to that quickly?
Yeah,
keep it to
2 minutes.
You know what I've said? I've said we have to turn things around right now. The legislators need you more than you need them because they're the ones who, they're your representatives anyway. So you in quotes, voted for them to be there. So they're representing you. So any information you arm them with is helpful. So capacity building is very, very important. Information sharing in helping to deepen their knowledge base is very critical as well. So they are the ones you find out, particularly those of us in the private sector, there are different areas they want to play in and they just need your support and your information from you. And all you do is provide that and guidance and they're fine with it. So what I'm saying here is that these legislators you are dealing with, because of the person you are, okay, and relationships you've built over time and a body of work which you have, you know, engendered over the time, okay, through writings, columns, and all that, you have now yourself become an authority in that area, okay, and to a point in which you now become a reference point as well. And for them, they just want to get their work done, okay. In the days as government relations people, you find out that anytime there's an issue, you know, legislators tell you that, listen, what is this thing you guys are talking about? And you say, no, you know what? Let me take you to one of my facilities for you to see hands-on what is on ground. So that's why you find out to a large extent, you take some of these legislators on factory tours and all that to educate them better, for them to see. Because again, sometimes when their legislative aides come up with some of these things, there are things that are just sifted from the internet. But you know what? You need to be able to separate the wheat from the chaff. And that is very, very critical.
Thank you.
Right now, it is incumbent upon us, yes, for the legislators to listen to us and for us to support them in any way we can.
Okay, before we leave this topic, any thoughts from you, Anne?
I think I was smiling and nodding as the other animator was speaking, because capacity building, you can't stress it enough. I recall one instance where we took some legislators to power plants in River State, if I remember correctly. And it was a 2-hour tour. You could tell that these supposed people who were writing laws and taking decisions with regards to the future of energy in the country had no clue, or at least needed our help. They needed, there was just so much oohing and eyeing throughout the trip that I told myself, I think we should do this more often, and we should do it, across the board. It is crucial. It is where we see our most impact. And I think if we really want to continue to contribute to advancing this country, advancing this region, it's something we must be very, very intentional about.
Thank you, distinguished panelists, ladies and gentlemen. Again, we are discussing managing reputation in the COVID-19 milieu. We have one more segment and we will quickly go into questions and answers. The questions are coming in torrents. We have more than 15 questions to deal with. But before we go into our question and answer session, Anne, I'm going to stay with you. And let's lead us into the discussion about handling cynicism and skepticism in public affairs. Before COVID-19 came upon us, and now that it is with us, do you notice any difference in the level of skepticism about organizations, about corporate bodies?
I would say it depends. I mean, at some point I would have said yes, but I think now it really depends. It depends on where your reputation, where your brand identity was pre-COVID to where it is based on maybe what you have done or the steps you have taken to invest in your brand reputation now and during and hopefully post-COVID. The level of cynicism should have increased if you did the right things, if you took the right steps, if you showed up as a corporate socially responsible organization, if you made sure that you took care of your employees and they remained, engaged and committed team members, brand ambassadors, if you continued your progressive lobbying with government, to advance and support, even as they have been pretty much blindsided by this pandemic, then definitely, of course, the level of cynicism and skepticism, in fact, the favorability index for your company would be totally different to what it was pre-COVID. Okay. If you didn't do any of that, then you can imagine where those popular graphs and charts, how they will be trending downwards right now.
Okay, thank you. Emeka, I'm going to come to you. How did you know? I think you have witchcraft. That's because you were laughing, because I was just coming to you. Now,
I'm a pope.
Yes, in your story, in your history, you have managed brand transitions more than 4 times.
Yeah.
You have managed management transitions more than 7 times. And you are a veteran of several corporate crises. Tell us, Emeka, how should organizations handle the cynicism that comes with this kind of things? Because some of us haven't dealt with some of those before.
Okay. Sometimes it gets really... Yeah. Okay, so one thing that is very important in managing cynicism is the credibility of the person managing it. That is really the key. And so if you use where I work as an instance, and I can take the liberty, in the days of Econet Wireless, as some of you know, there were a lot of issues. The directors were fighting, Lagos State Government, Akwa Ibom State Government, Delta State Government, their investors, there were court cases everywhere. I get a call from a municipal house. They give me an envelope containing something that some director has sent for them to publish. But you see, the only way I could navigate, and I think this is Anne's word, navigation. The only way I could navigate that trying time was by staying away from the crisis. So my credibility was high. I was not somebody that was brought by Lagos State Government or Delta State Government or Akwa Ibom State Government or anybody. So they saw me as some guy who came from Cadbury. In fact, people were sorry for me. Hey, this guy, you left your job in Cadbury and came to these very unserious people. I said, I'm enjoying it because it was fun. So I had no godfather, I had no godmother. I was simply being professional from one media house to the other, getting my job done with the media, engaging all the parties who were involved. And there were occasions when I was going to be compromised. And I'm like, no, it won't work because you want me to do writing public, cause a story to be published about a director. And I'm no, I have to let the MD know. If the MD says, yeah, then that's management decision. So a little bit of emotional intelligence for the person who is managing this crisis so that you can look credible, look impartial, look without prejudice. That's one. You have to have somebody who is totally dispassionate to manage the crisis for you, whether it's internal or an agency. The second thing is, one thing that was very clear to me was that there was no attempt to kill that business. So we are fighting for glory and fighting for whatever. But in everything they did, to be fair, they wanted that business to stay and to succeed. So every time there was a transition, it was meant to be an improvement of what was there before. So that boosted my own personal interest and motivated me to say, listen, they don't want this business to go under. They want this business to succeed. So we became Celtel. It was because somebody invested. We became Zen. It was another person invested. We became Airtel because another person invested. Each time we changed, we got better. So for me, I had a mindset of the owners of this business do not want to kill it. They want it to succeed. So that's the second thing. Whenever there's crisis, you're not fighting because you want it to end. You're fighting for it to be better. That has a way of working together with the credibility of the manager to make it happen. And for me, trust me, I made sure that I stayed away from the crisis, stayed aloof, focused on the professional work. And each time they went everywhere, every media house they went to, they'll say, talk to Emeka first. So that helped me to succeed in managing all the interests involved.
Okay. Thanks, Ade, let's come to you. You also have an interesting background. handling advocacy for very difficult corporate organizations, tobacco.
Yes.
With very passionate enemies and very passionate supporters.
Lovers.
So I bet it must come with a lot of cynicism, especially when you are talking to regulators. Share your experience.
Definitely. You know, what I found very interesting was, the analogy drawn by Emeka on your credibility. You see, we've always had a problem of what you call trust deficit. Trust deficit is not only with government. Trust deficit with some certain organizations as well. When you call their names, they say, oops. Okay? So the trust deficit, I mean, I worked for two organizations. We didn't have trust deficit per se, but we had cynicism. I'm talking about DSTV and British American Tobacco. British American Tobacco, for example, was in the business of selling cigarettes. But you know how I always played it? I always told them, I said, listen, you have a right to smoke if you want. It's your right. Advertising says you have the right to choose. If you choose to smoke, it is within your purview to smoke. The same way if you want to drink. And anytime I said that jokingly, it always resonated because I always said, okay. And half of the people we are talking to are closet smokers. I once went to a minister. And he was smoking in his office. And I came and told him, I said, okay, what's happening? He said, Ade, don't worry now. You know, I can't say that in public, but don't worry. I look at my packet of cigarettes here. I can't afford to, but you know what? I have to say what I have to say, but don't worry. In between it, you are doing your job. You are doing your job professionally. And that is what I want you to continue to do. And you know, the credibility you have built over time, your person, okay? Even amongst your respective stakeholders, you know, even your adversarial stakeholders, because people forget the fact that your stakeholders don't have to be your friends all the time. You have adversarial stakeholders who respect you, okay? They are your competitors, but they respect you because of your stance and your person and what you stand for. So that's on the tobacco side. Then on the DSTV side, where people are talking about the fact that, you know, particularly one instance was the Big Brother one. People said, shower hour, this and that. What did I tell people? I said, listen, you have a right. Big Brother is optional. Okay? If you want to watch, you watch. Where you have the parental control thing, all you need to do is to activate this, that parental control area, or that area which doesn't allow you to watch the supposed nudism that you saw in there. It's pure and simple. As at any time I went to National Assembly, the National Assembly guys would tell me, I don't worry now. It means if they watch out. I said, yeah, so what's the problem? I said, maybe I'll walk away with it, though. You know, so you know, it's about the relationship. So, and that's how I was able to navigate that area. And it's a constant thing, you know. So right now, the only problem we have now is this citizen. Look at this COVID, for example. Okay, Emeka and I have spoken numerous times off Zoom. How people do not believe that COVID-19 exists. There's so much cynicism and skepticism, and they're saying to themselves, no, government is just, you know, budgeting money to, you know. And that's the problem because of the trust deficit between the citizens and the government. And that has to be worked on by government on a continuous basis. And I'm quite impressed by the PTF daily handlings of, you know, telling us what is happening in respective sectors.
Yeah.
And I think that's a very good step, where you have multiple stakeholders speaking to different issues. And I think that's, but you know what? What is currently happening now is that, you know, every country has invested with one, you know, stimulus or the other. Okay, we have different stimuli. But in Nigeria, you cannot really pinpoint what that stimulus is. Okay? You're trying to hit that stimulus button, okay, but you can't seem to find it. So right now, they are all saying to themselves, you know, right now I'm far from the maddening crowd. Apologies to, you know, who. Eh? So that is the problem. And that's what we are facing currently. So okay. You see, this is our job.
Mr. Joe, I don't need to add very quickly.
One minute for you, sir.
Yes, please. You see, the social contract between the government of Nigeria and the people, I'm sorry to say, but that's what it is. No matter how we try to mask it, that contract has its challenge now. So, and it's affecting corporate organizations. So because they doubt government, anything private organizations do, and they see that you are trying to tend towards supporting government, the cynicism also spreads to you. And that's the point I want to make, as it affects us. Yeah. A company donates money, and somebody says to you, why are you donating money to government? You should have donated the money directly. You know they're going to squander the money. They'll eat it, all of you together. So the cynicism is such that beyond believability or not of COVID, they have gone beyond.
Hello?
Colluding, collaborating with government, you know, to do XYZ. So if their contract with government is broken, which are they say, government should work on it. Now it's beginning to affect corporate organizations as well in their private capacity. So that's also a challenge for us to make sure we try. Now, at any moment we're working with government, we socially distance ourselves from what government is doing so that we are not seen as in cahoots with them.
Okay. Thank you. And very quickly, you also work in an interesting sector, energy and power. Nigeria is a gas zone, and power, PHCN, you know, is what it is. What
sorry,
is cynicism like? What's your experience?
Sorry, Adina, what you said and what you're proposing to Anne is very funny, because people talk about the fact that, you know, oil and gas. Okay, we have a lot of gas, we're flaring it, what's happening? So those kind of questions are the kind of questions that you get the layman asking. With all the oil, power we have, with all, what's happening?
You know, exactly. So you deal with both, you deal with government people, you deal with, the financial sector where you want to raise money and all of that. With all the challenges around power, gas, and energy, what's cynicism like in your experience? If you can do that in 2 minutes, so that we can deal with the deluge of questions that we have.
I can't count how many conversations that start with, oh, so you're in power, why don't I have lights? And then I have to take 10 steps back to say, look, you know what, I work for GE, we manufacture turbines, and that's just in the generation. Yes. There's an entire value chain. There's transmission that we need to fix. There's distribution that we need to fix. There's all the losses, commercial and technical, that you guys are not paying, that we need to fix. It has to be end to end. And they're like, yeah, but you know, how much have we spent? Government has been spending and is still spending, and we never see power. This is all, like, it's to America, and at this point, at some point, you know, you have to find a way to navigate between promoting and advocating what you really stand for as an organization, and then, you know, just dealing with the reality of government and the reality of the challenge that they are facing here, specifically related to power. 15 years in the industry, I can tell you that some days even I am like, you know what do we need to do to fix this thing? Because it is a colossal problem. And you can empathize with people's frustrations, with their pain, with how much they spend on a daily basis, you know, just to provide their own power. But again, it doesn't take from the fact that, you know, you have to stay true and authentic to what your organization stands for, what you do, do it well, right? To make sure that your own personnel, your organization doesn't have a trust deficit, because that would be really problematic. And then work hand in hand with your stakeholders. I always say people erroneously have the impression that relationship is only one way, like it's only upwards. The proper relationship model is a team model. You should build it upwards with all your stakeholders, if it's government, you know, up the hierarchy. You should build it across board. And I'm saying this because of the people, I mean, I think we have lots of people on the call, right? You should build it across board to your peers. And then you should also build it downwards, because people who will give you some context, who will give you information, who will help you craft your messaging to align with, you know, government and your corporate interests may not necessarily be only the people on top.
Okay. Thank you, Anne. The distinguished panelists, ladies and gentlemen, we're still discussing managing reputation in the COVID-19 milieu. Let's take time to take some of these questions. If the question is directed to a particular panelist, I will mention it. Otherwise, any of the panelists can take the questions. Let's keep the answers to one minute so that we can deal with as many questions as possible. So this question is from Abiye Krukrubo, who I know is also an experienced practitioner. Abiye is asking, can you share with us how to maintain your strategic narrative in this era of COVID-19?
The strategic narrative, that's a bit of a, you know, I'm struggling to understand the question. Strategic narrative.
No, it says, with all the challenges that COVID-19 brings, how does the communicator maintain his strategic narrative despite all the distractions that COVID-19 brings and the disruptions that it brings to the way we work? How does an organization...
Okay, let me. Can I come in, Adi?
Go ahead.
There's a story of Coca-Cola. I'm sure many of us are familiar. Now, during the Second World War, Coca-Cola continued to advertise until the war was over, even though there was no Coca-Cola being supplied anywhere. But when the war was over, people remembered Coke. And that's one of the key reasons that they are still, I mean, whatever they are. Now, what am I saying? We know that the news media online, everywhere, is populated by COVID-19, this, COVID-19, that. But the storytelling, telling the story of our organizations, or our strategic narrative, must continue unabated. But of course, now in a more creative and a more COVID-compliant way. You are not expected at a time when people are dying, people are sick, people are desperate, to be boisterous in your communication. So communication now has to be tempered in a manner of speaking to be tailored towards what's happening. In the first two months of COVID, we diverted most of our marketing budget to running awareness campaigns across Nigeria in Pidgin English and local languages. I mean, we're still in the market. We're still talking about business, but we're talking to the people. So the story changed slightly to show compassion, to show empathy with the people. We are still selling our broadband data on television and on radio. We are still buying news agencies to advertise our product. But like I said, you can't be too boisterous when people are suffering. You can't be, who is even buying newspapers, you know, and so on and so forth. If you go online now, the conversations are basically about COVID, survival. We also need to come into that space to help them, while at the same time telling our story, pushing our narrative. You are a telecoms company, by the way. You must continue to provide services. This Zoom class is happening right on the telecoms network for everybody, depending on which one. We must make sure our shops are open. We must make sure we ask our customers to come to the shops. We'll tell them we have new products and services and how to access our products, especially during this period where contactless kind of service is required. And this is speaking about telecom. But generally speaking, everybody should still be out there discussing what your business is all about so that people don't forget you after COVID. COVID will end. It may not end, by the way, like I say, it may become endemic. But even if it becomes endemic, life will have to continue. So whatever you do to make money, whatever you do to business, you continue to tell the narrative or try to moderate it in such a way that it fits the psychology of the people at the time.
Okay, thank you, Emeka.
As an addendum to that, you must always listen to understand. It's important to listen to understand.
Okay.
So that should be just the takeaway. I don't want to go into listen to understand. Understand the situation in which we find ourselves, show empathy, show compassion. Okay.
Yes.
This is not the time for you to engage in what you call serious, brand. I mean, you can build a brand without being boisterous in doing that. Okay.
Okay. So thank you, Ade. Important. We have a question from Ndumneche Ezurike, ND, also an experienced practitioner. ND would like the panel to talk to how companies can transit from doing CSR that is merely convenient to sustainable practices that would achieve shared prosperity between the community and the organization. Again, ND's question is, shed some light on or share some insight on how a company could transit from the old mode of a convenient CSR to sustainable practices that is beneficial to both the organization as well as the communities.
Can I take that quickly?
Go ahead, Ade.
CSR is a two-way street. You must be seen to, it's a two-way street. And the other speakers had alluded to it earlier on, talking about doing business in a sustainable way. It must be mutually beneficial to both parties. Communities where you operate, you know their needs. And so you see, we should get ourselves off this CSR as tokenism. A lot of organizations, practice CSR as tokenism. It shouldn't be. It should be a way of life. It should be sustainable, and it should be, it should be partnership between both the communities where you operate and the company. So partnerships that work. On a continuous basis right now, COVID has opened those realities and has brought those realities to bear. So organizations that are involved, be it agriculture, telecoms, impact. It must be CSR that is impactful. Impactful. And when it's impactful, we all have what we call what? Shared prosperity.
Okay, thank you. Another question from John Ade. He says, in the connected world, it's very easy to use social media to threaten or damage reputation. What strategies exist to proactively protect reputation assets? Anne, do you want to take it?
Yes, absolutely. I saw this question on the question panel. And I think the tactics you use to protect your reputation already from a traditional point of view also apply. One, the lies and truths are mutually exclusive, right? So when people go on social media and they're trying to, promote falsehoods, it's very, facts don't lie, right? So you use facts, same way you would use for traditional media, for broadcast media. You use, number one, face the facts and persistently face the facts. Number two, don't get driven by emotion. Because I see a lot of people just, no tact, no thinking, no strategy behind how they go on social, and they just go and type on a corporate channel. And I'm like, guys, come on. There has to be strategic intent with how you push and promote your messaging, even on social media channels. When you see that someone is actively trying to bend, twist, use motives that, again, are false, or depicting, watering down the truth, repeat the facts without emotion, and consistently repeat the facts.
Okay, thank you.
Let me give a one-liner there. Facts are sacred. Opinion is free.
Okay.
Facts are sacred, opinion is free. So half of them are expressing opinion, not based on facts. But facts are sacred, and that's what they are, truth. But opinion is free, and anybody can offer an opinion. Everybody has a POV, all our points of view.
Okay, thank you, Ade.
It's interesting.
Okay, go ahead, Ade,
even on Twitter, for someone as important, as well-known, as politically out there as President Trump, Twitter put fact-checkers on his tweets.
That's
right. Facts don't lie. So to at this point, facts are sacred. And once you stick to the facts and you persist with them, I mean, the lies will fade away.
Okay, thanks. Emeka, if you kindly take the question from Okwi Onia, and his question is that, he backgrounds it a little bit, but essentially, Okwi is saying, look, he envisages a lot of increased regulation by government on several sectors because of the desperation to deal with the pandemic, as well as increase revenue and steer the economy away from recession. So his question against that background is, how should the corporate communications professional manage the changing dynamics such that the business agenda will remain protected? Emeka, do you want to take a shot on that for 1 minute?
Yeah, sure. Now, the reality is that when, as they say, when the music changes, the dance steps will also change. And he's right. We're anticipating changes. We're anticipating a lot of more challenges in that area. Revenues are no longer coming in as it should be. So you expect that government is going to get a bit more aggressive. And of course, being proactive in business management or in leadership is ability to anticipate what the future will bring. Any business that is not currently looking at the different scenarios now must be in trouble. The idea is you must look at the scenario, look at the situation. Where do I think that the Minister of Communication will come from? Where do I think the CC will come from? Where do I think that other regulators in the industry will come from? By the way, Mr. Adedayo, most state governments during the pandemic reduced, and some of them completely wiped out the cost of laying fiber. In fact, one of the greatest challenges we had in the past 1 or 2 years was how to lay fiber, what you call right of way. We continue to ask for them to reduce the cost. Do you know what? On their own, during this pandemic, most of them canceled it. It's free. They are begging us to come because now they have found out that they can't do Zoom. They can't do calls. They cannot, you know, we are offering them infrastructure. They are charging us money. They are discouraging us. So to be honest with you, to answer a quick question, it works both ways. Government is beginning to realize that they cannot be an island unto themselves. Finally, they are beginning to ask us to come and lay a fiber free of charge. And they can tell Airtel to come lay fiber because they know they couldn't make their Zoom calls. They couldn't even establish calls. So they're begging us. So in a way, it's a blessing in disguise. But that's just one aspect. There are several things that you must see, anticipate what could happen. Taxes are going to increase. Levies are going to increase. They're going to change those laws, even though they know your revenues are shrinking. So we must be ready, as they will say, to engage these people on an ongoing basis so that they see reason why you cannot raise taxes when my revenues have shrunk even further.
Okay, thank you, Emeka. Distinguished ladies and gentlemen, unfortunately, we still have several questions, but our time is going. But as they say, you know, it is always sweet to chew the meat in the mouth for so long. However, there is always a pull on the throat. So, you know, for the sake of managing the calendar of our distinguished panelists as well as participants, we'll take only two more questions and go to the other aspects and make sure we round up over the next few minutes. The next question is from Iyabo Ayobamiojo, who I know is also a very experienced practitioner. She says, in the public sector, especially for those organizations owned by government or in which government have significant interest, how do we manage crisis that emanates from either the actions or inactions of the same entity, government, without indicting your principals and also resolve all issues of conflict? I think every panelist should take a minute to deal with that question. I think it's very interesting. Ade, do you want to start?
interesting dynamics, you know, public sector, private sector, two different sectors, the way you play differently. The public sector, you have to be very, very careful because of the fact that the boss is always right. So that is always a problem you have. But again, it depends on how you are able to navigate it. Relationships, again, are important. And again, there are a lot of things that can be done through third parties in influencing or trying to manage those crises without it directly coming from you. So that is critical, but critical for the public sector. But the public sector as well, to a large extent, must not see itself, okay? Must see itself as a social service, okay? And respecting the contract between the people and between the people and government, okay? And trying to bring to fore the positives of that policy or action. And again, when there's inaction, the consequences of such inaction and how it affects, you know, the overall well-being of the citizenry.
Thank you. Emeka, don't answer that question. Let me give you Dozier Arinze's question. Dozier says, reputation managers are still working in silos. Do you have any thoughts on knowledge sharing, on how knowledge sharing can be upped in a systematic way?
Oh, yes. Number one, I need Dozier Arinze on this Zoom call next time. Because Dozier is extremely knowledgeable. He needs to come on and share his experience. That's number one strategy. The second strategy is that I'm willing to continue to share my own experience and knowledge. I think on a more serious note, what you're doing today is fantastic. We've done a couple of it before. We need to do more of this. We need to come together. This is the time. There are many young people there who are, I've gone through the questions. There are many young people who need knowledge, who need, you don't need to be 70 years to have experience. If, as my father told me, if you befriend old people, you become old in time. So if these guys can benefit from from an amalgamation of all the experience and knowledge we have, they will benefit. I think we need to begin to have, we need to have a platform where we all come together on an ongoing basis. We shouldn't make it rather very perfunctory, but let's get into a system where we have regular interactions. People should begin to write books. I know, you did one. And we need to write books. People who are in this industry should begin to write books, commit to write more articles, commit their knowledge to writing so that people will share and people can come onto these platforms. In this social distancing or personal distancing thing, as they will say.
Physical distance.
We can continue doing Zoom conversations, but there's a lot of knowledge to be shared. I'm currently doing a book on crisis management. Every time you say, Emeka, you know, I'm doing a book on crisis. I hope I'm going to get it ready this year and share it. It's totally local, totally Nigerian, not ICI, not the usual Tylenol example. Local examples, talking about Airtel, talking about Zane, talking about Indomie, talking about ADC Airlines. Local examples, things that happen, how they handled it. We need to begin to commit this knowledge into writing so people can benefit it. We'll share knowledge on these platforms. And
thank you. Thank you, Emeka.
Just one comment, Ade. I think maybe just one recommendation for senior professionals like us to be very intentional about sharing our knowledge and not to wait for, you know, broad-based platforms where we can speak to thousands and hundreds of people. We should not shy away from the small groups, right, where we can really go have some depth and really share context, and groom people in our small circles, 20, 50, 30 people. Right, we shouldn't only wait for this, you know, broad, large-scale communication platforms to share knowledge, and it should be an ongoing process.
Okay, and we'll throw the last question at you before we go round this up. It's from Diran Onifade. I'm sure many of us still remember Diran at NTA, the veteran NTA, yes. Of subs, of many battles himself. Diran's question is: should brands still continue to devote huge budgets to the mass media when it seems the masses have gone social post COVID-19? And
I will refer to my interview when I was joining GE, right? And one of the questions that I answered, I said, look, the days of power graphs and pages of text are slowly going away. You need to be able to compress all that information into lines, to use Twitter, 256 words, You need to have that skill to compress, to speed. It's a new world. Now, will all the budgets be diverted? I doubt it. I think not, because there are some platforms, I mean, maybe not on the local level, but you know, Channels, for example, still has huge viewership on the 10 p.m. news. CNN still gets its coverage, its viewership on the daily basis, right? So I'm hard pressed to say that it's totally gone, but yes, there is a wave. There's a wave that communicators must embrace and navigate and manage and you know, just go side by side along as these things evolve. And it will keep evolving. That's just it. Digital is here to stay. It's our new normal. It will keep evolving. I think every 6 months you need to go back to your media platform or media map and, you know, reduce some graphs and increase some graphs, because, I mean, things will change. Papers will die off and others will come up.
Okay, so distinguished ladies and gentlemen, it's good. It's going to be the final word from all three of you, but you go ahead, 45 seconds from each panelist. So your time starts now. Emeka.
The one-liner I'm going to give based on what Anne said is, take your message where the people are. There's no debate about it. Take your message where the people are. And when it comes to all that we are doing today, crisis communication, I'm very passionate about what practitioners should do. I think I need to reiterate the fact that we need to earn our respect in our various organizations. We need to earn our respect as professionals. We need to become knowledgeable. You can only become knowledgeable if you read. If you read, 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 read. And then you have to now earn more respect if you write. When people know that you have something and you can share it, people will respect you. Nobody will light a candle and put it under the bushel. When they read you or read Anne or read Ade, they know that this guy has got something to offer. Build your network very well so that your company will not go and look for an outsider to help them to get Obasanjo, to get Buhari, to come for your event or to help sign off a document. Be the man in your organization. Build your connection and have your contacts in the media. Don't play with it.
Thank you. Are there final words? 45 seconds.
Quick one. Be the go-to person in your organization. Very important. The body of work you've built over time, share it. And thirdly, we talked about the fact that will social media or the digital be the new normal? You have to appropriate accordingly. You know your audience and you know your target market. Some will be mass media, some will be radio, and some will be digital. So appropriate accordingly, according to your audience. So at this point in time, I want to say, I really want to thank you for organizing this webinar. I think it was intellectually stimulating, and I hope the viewers found it stimulating and intellectually rewarding as well.
Okay, the one that is blessed among men, Anne, final words.
Really, really blessed. So, I mean, I think, guys, your strategic initiative is not cast in stone. As you read and you listen, adapt, be flexible. Make sure you take the cues you're getting from your environment and you navigate your strategic initiative around those cues so that you continue to stay relevant. You cannot be stuck on one strategic initiative when the ship has sailed, like the world has moved on. So listen, be flexible, continue to make sure that you pull in the outside world into what you're doing internally, so that what you take externally is reflective of your true mission.
Thank you very much, panelists. You know, I thought 90 minutes was a lot of time, but here we are, it's all fizzled out. We've heard a lot from our distinguished panelists, the importance of preparedness, training, the increasing relevance of citizens, season the agenda, and CSR transiting into sustainability. We cannot overemphasize the importance of being knowledgeable and following processes. I wish we had more time, but with that, I will turn it over to my colleague, Joseph Aja, who is the coordinator of this event and director of operations at Caritas, to round this up for us. Josie?
All right, thank you very much, Dayo. Hello, everyone, once again. My name is Joseph Aja, and on behalf of the Reputation Solutions Faculty, I want to thank everyone for joining us on this webinar today. The Reputation Solutions Faculty is a unit of Caritas Communications, and is committed to enabling useful conversations around subjects that impact our roles as communication consultants and practitioners. Our hope is that these conversations will help to elevate standards in the industry. We are immensely grateful to our panelists who have done great justice to our topic today, managing reputation in the COVID-19 milieu. All of you are great stars in your own right. And Eze, Communications Director for GE's Gas Power Business for Sub-Saharan Africa, Ade Adefeko, Vice President, Corporate and Government Relations at Olam Nigeria, and Emeka Opara, Vice President, Corporate Communications and CSR Airtel. We thank you so much, and we will definitely call on you again to come and share your knowledge and experiences. We want to thank our moderator, Ade Dayo Ojo, CEO of Caritas Communications, a veteran of the communications industry and an author. Our thanks to all the people who have worked tirelessly in the background to make this webinar happen. We also thank our friends from the media who have joined us on this webinar. And most of all, we thank you, our guests, our participants, who responded to our call and made this webinar the success that it is. We do not take you for granted. This is the first in a series of webinars from the Reputation Solutions faculty. Please respond when we invite you again. The recording of this webinar will be posted on YouTube at the Caritas YouTube page. We want to thank everyone for joining us. We will continue to do more. And to take from Dozie Arinze's question about sharing knowledge, this is only one aspect of what we intend to do. So we will be doing a lot more, and we will be getting in touch with you. Thank you, everyone, and stay safe.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. God bless you and enjoy your weekend.
We will. Thank you. Cheers.
Bye-bye.
Thank you very much.
Bye. Thank you, guys.